The following is a lecture given by His Holiness Rin Sugubu on the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 24, Text 18, on June 2nd, 2001, in Philadelphia.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Srimad Bhagavatam, the third canto, 24th chapter, the renunciation of Kardama Muni, text number 18, Lord Brahma's addressing Devahuti. Translation. Lord Brahma then told Devahuti, "My dear daughter of Manu, the same Supreme Personality of Godhead who killed the demon Kaitaba is now within your womb. He will cut off all the knots of your ignorance and doubt. Then you will travel all over the world." Srila Prabhupada's purport. Here the word avidya is very significant. Avidya means forgetfulness of one's identity. Every one of us is a spirit soul. But we have forgotten. We think I am this body. This is called avidya. Samshaya granti means doubtfulness. The knot of doubtfulness is tied when the soul identifies with the material world. That knot is called ahankara, the junction of matter and spirit. By proper knowledge received from the scriptures in disciplic succession, and by proper application of that knowledge, one can free himself from this binding combination of matter and spirit. Brahma assures Devahuti that her son will enlighten her, and after enlightening her, he will travel all over the world distributing the system of Sankhya philosophy. The word samshaya means doubtful knowledge. Speculative and pseudo-yogic knowledge is all doubtful. At the present moment, the so-called yoga system is prosecuted on the understanding that by agitation of the different stations of the bodily construction, one can find that he is God. The mental speculators think similarly, but they are all doubtful. Real knowledge is expounded in Bhagavad Gita. Just become Krishna conscious. Just worship Krishna and become a devotee of Krishna. That is real knowledge, and anyone who follows that system becomes perfect, without a doubt. The text again. Esha manavite garbham pravishta kaitabharadhanaha avidya samshaya grantim chitva gam charishyati. Lord Brahma then told Devahuti, "My dear daughter of Manu, the same Supreme Personality of Godhead who killed the demon, Kaitava, is now within your womb. He will cut off all the knots of your ignorance and doubt. Then he will travel all over the world." So here, Devahuti is being reassured. Remember, she was nervous, fearful actually, and had asked her husband, "How is my, you've satisfied all my desires, but you have not freed me from fear. By She wants to become fearless. Means a fear of death, fear of bondage, repeated birth and death in the material world. That fear. How will you relieve me from that? So he tells her, now you'll get a son who will do that. So Brahma is confirming here that your son, who's now entered your womb, is none other than the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And here an analogy is made between his killing a demon, Kaitava demon, and his cutting or destroying the Hridaya Granthi, the knot in the heart. That knot here is described. You find this word throughout the Bhagavatam. It's described in different ways, but it's here the junction between matter and spirit, means false ego. This is the knot that binds ultimately the soul to the material world. And so this knot has to be for liberation, for freedom from fear. This knot has to be destroyed. How will that knot be destroyed? The Lord will destroy it, actually, the same way he destroyed the demon. In the fifth canto, the comparison is made between the Lord's killing Hiranyakashipu and his destroying Karmashayan, which is described in another verse as also the granthi, the knot. The Karmashayan means the eagerness to enjoy fruitive activities in the material world. That is the knot. Prahlad prays to the Lord and the Sringadeva to appear in his heart and destroy this knot. The same way that he destroyed Hiranyakashipu, who is the emblem of material desires, or the desire to enjoy in this world independently of God. So here are the same ideas there. It is recalled how he killed this demon. So you're worried about his competence to do this job. You should understand he can do it. And his method now, how he destroys this knot, is by Sankhya philosophy. In a fairly pacifistic way, he liberates the world. And so here, Prabhupada says that this first of all applies. He will do this for Devahuti, and then travel all over the world, and everyone will be benefited by the same knowledge, but she will be the first recipient of his mercy. He will deliver her first of all. So this knot is described here as Vidya Samshaya Grantim. The two components of this knot, Vidya and Samshaya. So Vidya, Prabhupada describes as forgetfulness. Literally, it means without vidya or knowledge. But in a very Platonic way, this ignorance is seen as forgetfulness. In other words, knowledge is something that originally we knew and have forgotten. It's not, this is a very important point, it's not an import from the outside. It's already something we have forgotten. And actually, just like when we've forgotten something and remember it, we recall it to mind, or to consciousness, we discover that it had to already be there, and somehow or other we just didn't have access to it. So similarly, this knowledge is forgetfulness. Forgetfulness of what? My actual identity, who I am. This is a bad mistake to make. because on the premise of this bad mistake, everything else is done. You make one mistake, and then everything else you do, no matter how intelligent, heroic, intrepid, brilliant, brave, is useless, because it's all based on this mistake. Just as if you're in a desert and you mistake by a mirage, some cloud bank for water, and then you go through huge toil and heroism, endurance to get to that water, you've just gotten yourself in more trouble. So all your virtues turn to your own defeat. This is the history of the modern world. Certainly they do wonderful heroic activities, but it all comes to defeat because of this forgetfulness. People don't know who they are. Therefore, when they want to secure their own welfare, they don't go to the right way. They look to the welfare of the body and the mind, and not to the actual self. So in spite of all efforts, they don't become better. They don't become happy. In fact, it actually becomes worse, because so this I am this body. Prabhupada says we think I am this body. Often we don't think it, we just presuppose it. It's a mute idea. It's one that's so obvious you don't have to say it. Everybody knows it. And if you tell people you're not your body, sometimes they think you're being contradictory. You're trying to say I'm not me. When an idea is very strongly held, we see this in history of philosophy, when an idea is very strongly held, it becomes so self-evident to people that to deny it, it sounds like it's a contradiction. They've just defined it. I am my body is just true by definition. So if you deny it, you're saying I'm not me, because they have no knowledge of the actual self. So this is avidya. People are sunk in this avidya. Samshaya granti means doubtfulness, the samshaya doubt. The knot of doubtfulness is tied when the soul identifies with the material world. So on the one hand, avidya samsara, I don't know that I'm a spirit soul, and I think I'm the body, and therefore I'm identify myself as a material product and as someone that belongs in the material world. And then from that mistake, all my enterprises go in the wrong direction. What do I get? Maya Sukha, illusory happiness, or as Prabhupada calls it, the illusory advancement of civilization. It looks like advancement, but in the end, because it's illusory, you'll see no one has gotten anywhere. So then specifically he ties this dot and calls this not this ahankara. Ahankara. Literally, the I maker. Aham is I, and kara means maker. Like a name for the sun is Bhaskara, ray maker. Makes rays. So ahankara makes I. It gives us our sense of I. But because this ahankara in Kapila's system will be identified as one of the subtle material elements, it's the most subtle of them. Subtle means hard to perceive. So there's the gross elements, solids and liquids and gases and so on, earth, water, fire, air, ether, Earth is the grossest because it contains five sense objects and is the easiest to perceive. Whereas, for example, space, a little bit subtle. You can't see it, touch it, taste it, smell it. Somehow or other, it's there somehow or other, you know. Accommodating space, it's not nothing. But it's subtle. But then even subtler is mind. Mind is so subtle that philosophers and thinkers have denied its existence. It's just really a way of talking about behavior or dispositions to behave. In other words, I am angry doesn't refer to some subtle interior state, but really the fact that my skin is turning red, my teeth are grinding, and I have a tendency to scream. That's what it means to say I am angry. It doesn't refer to some occult, hidden, ghostly process going on. This is called philosophical behaviorism, this particular school of thought. They deny the existence of mind as a separate category. The ghost and the machine. That's because it's subtle. It cannot be studied or examined by the same methods. People have to report, at least so far, what's on their minds, or disclose it by their gross behavior. Otherwise, you don't know. Then there's buddhi, manas. All these interior things are divided into different. Buddhi is even more subtle. People who are mental speculators, very adept on the mental, what Prabhupada calls the mental platform, very active and agile, hopping around from ideas to ideas, think fast. Still, when it comes to buddhi, they may be quite hopeless. In fact, people have very hard time understanding what is actual buddhi. The faculty of discrimination, we usually translate it as intelligence, but it's not what people mean by intelligence, because you can be quite adept on the mental platform and still be bereft of buddhi. You can get a very high IQ score and have very little buddhi. The platform of buddhi is Bhagavad Gita. The universities and colleges, Prabhupada says, are the culture of the mind. But for the culture of buddhi, intelligence, you have to go to Bhagavad Gita, where a devotional service is called buddhi yoga. So that's pretty subtle. Not many people actually understand buddhi and know how to cultivate buddhi. Because one of the main functions of buddhi is the correct placement of faith. Then beyond that, even more subtle, ahankara. You think space is subtle or mind is subtle. Where do you get to ahankara? It's very subtle. But the thing is that we also discover from Kapila Dev is that the more subtle something is, the more powerful. Is also opposite of what people think. That's why the pen is mightier than the sword, for example. So this ahankara, this identification of the self with the material, this false sense of who I am, that's why it's very powerful and it's very subtle. Subtle means we don't think about it, we just assume it. I don't go around thinking I'm my body, I just know that. So it's not the kind of thing that comes up for a critical exam. Am I really my body? Only in very few circles does anyone ever have this question, who am I really? And by body also we mean the mind. Many thinkers identify strongly with the subtle body. And yet they're very, very attached. They don't know that when I'm not the body, it also means I'm not my mind. And if you eliminate that, people think, well, what's left? What's left? Of course, we know the actual sign or symptom of the soul is consciousness. This consciousness, we should understand, is not part of the material structure of things. It's a different order of existence. And Krishna explains this, his summary of Sankhya, in the 7th chapter, that the world arises from the confluence of these two energies, the eightfold separated energy, which you can expand to all the Sankhya categories, and then the other is the spirit soul. Both of them have their origin in Krishna, but the souls itself have come, so to speak, from different directions and come together. How do they come together? Ahankara, that's the knot. They're knotted together by this ahankara. Actually, the soul has nothing to do with the material body. It's actually not even affected. There's no direct causal interactions. Nevertheless, the soul, when it acquires the false ego, thinks, perceives itself as the body and as the mind. And it appears as if the mind and the body work on the soul. That's what it means to be a conditioned soul. And therefore, you're now in the world of doubtfulness. You don't know what the future will bring, and you don't know how to... You turn to your senses for sources of knowledge, and these are always doubtful. So you grope your way through this world, and then you die, and you're born again, and you grope a little more, and then you die, and you grope a little more, and you never know what's happening here. This is the ahankara. So this has to be, so here you see this idea of what the problem is this ahankar, this knot has to be untied. What is the cause of our bondage and how do we untie it? So here, harking back to the previous verse, by proper knowledge received from scriptures in disciplic succession, that is to say, there's information given from basically outside the material system. It's coming down in a certain way. And so first of all, there has to be, this is the jnana part, that you've received information that's valid, that's not compromised. There's no confusion. Everything that comes from knowledge based on ahankara is confused. If that ahankara is there, everything you say is wrong. And so it's not reliable. It's based on the disease, not the cure. So therefore, but here's another source of knowledge that is not subjected to this samshaya, avidya samshaya, coming down through disciplic succession. And then, so that's the first thing, by proper knowledge received from the scriptures in disciplic succession, and part two, by proper application of that knowledge, that's the vijnana part, it has to be applied knowledge. One can free himself from the binding combination of matter and spirit. You have to know what to do, and you have to put it into action. It's very practical or pragmatic. If you're not interested in freeing yourself from the binding combination of matter and spirit, this will not help you. If you're interested in life as winning baseball games or making money in the stock market, you'll not be interested in this knowledge. It will seem like a useless waste of time. However, if you are a discerning person and understand life a little more deeply, you'll understand that everything else is a useless waste of time. This is the only worthwhile thing to do. If you spend your life vainly, never come to this point of dealing with this issue, it's wasted. Proper knowledge received from the scriptures in disciplic succession and by proper application of that knowledge. It has to be applied because this knowledge is treatment for the disease of the soul. If you go to medical school and you learn how to cure disease, but you never come close to one patient to do a thing, what's the value of it? So similarly with this knowledge, it is treatment. We are in a diseased condition of soul. This is described by many, many people, not just our tradition, like the poet Yeats describing the soul, sick with desire and fastened to a dying animal, it knows not what it is. Sick with desire. That desire to enjoy in the world is disease. And it's fastened us to the material body, a dying animal. We don't know who we are. That's our condition. So the treatment has to be there. It has to be applied. Therefore, he has given us also the application of different rules and regulations. So if one's serious, one has to apply this knowledge. We then can understand why is it. The first thing, of course, we should understand is what is the problem with sense gratification. Because here every system of transcendentalists prescribe reduction of sense gratification to the minimum. The prescription is as enough to be healthy. That's how much is allowed. Why is that? Because this ahankara, what causes this ahankara, is sense gratification. One will never become free from this identification of the self with the material body as long as one is trying to enjoy the senses in the material world. As soon as there's sense gratification, there's formation and intensification and hardening of the false ego. It becomes like a kind of encaging armor that will not be dissolved. So you have to understand the difference between the self and matter, the false ego, the subtle body, the gross body. You have to understand these things. These are like a map of the territory. I mean, it's a useful map for our purposes. People will not see it relevant to their lives. They'll say, what use of it is? We have our periodic table of elements, and with that we've been able to progress so much. What use is this? Well, this is for a different purpose. It's a different map. Territory may be the same, but the map is different. You want a geological survey map with no roads on it, and you want to take an automobile trip, you're going to have a problem. Because the maps pick out the relevant features. Relevant means relevant for your purpose. This is our purpose, to get out of the material world. Here's Krishna's map. Use it. So it's been handed down this way, and people have practiced it. There's a whole history of people who have gone through this and understood it by their own experience. This is what Prabhupada means by realized knowledge. They've applied it, and they've found out for themselves what is there. Because one has a difficulty sometimes with these descriptions that Prabhupada gives about perfect knowledge. How it's received through disciplic succession. So if the source is infallible, what's perfect, not free from conditions, and then is passed down through disciplic succession, then you wonder, well, is that disciplic succession also infallible? And the only reason I know that the source is, there are many, the source is infallible, is that I learned it from the authorities in the disciplic succession anyway. I mean, there's a lot of competition around for infallible sources. We have the Bhagavad Gita, somebody else has the Bible, somebody else has the Quran, and each one of them makes the claim, this is it, this is our infallible source. So how do we know this is it? Just to claim you are, not sufficient condition. Not only that, we say it's given by the civic succession and then it's passed down, one after another. So even if it is infallible to begin with, how do I know that it's preserved? People haven't added their own little twist to it. It hasn't become covered over by the local political and social circumstances of bygone times and so on. And things haven't been left behind and other things imported and so on. And I guess I better reject tradition like a good Protestant and go right back to the Bible and try to become one of the direct disciples of Christ like the apostles, which of course many people did, received direct instructions from the Bible, and the Bible turned out to be telling everybody different things. also that when you don't trust tradition anymore, then you become the authority. You become the authority. I accept this part, I don't accept that part. Well, sometimes traditions do fall apart. That's also a fact. Krishna mentions that in the fourth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, they become destroyed. But how this actually works is described in another place, which also talks about the knot in the heart. This is the Locus Classicus text. Toward the end of Divinity and Divine Service 1-2, where it describes the progress of devotional service, the modes of passion and ignorance disappear. These are all clinical signs. One becomes established in goodness. And then, Bhagavatattva Vijnanam, there's, as Prabhupada describes, positive scientific knowledge. Positive, meaning like positivistic, I mean it's based on perception. This vijnana is experienced knowledge, perceived knowledge. Maybe people don't perceive it who are materialists, but then they're not in a position to perceive it. To perceive it, you have to be in the right position, the right existential position that's already been described. Then what happens? Vidyate hridaya grantis, there's our buddy, they're not hridaya granti. Chidyante sarva samshaya, there's sarva samshaya, all doubts are cut to pieces. Kshiyante chasya karmani, drista evatmanishvare. Thus the knot in the heart is pierced, and all misgivings are cut to pieces. Samshaya, also misgivings. The chain of fruitive actions is terminated. That's over too. All karma is finished. When one sees the self as master. Now, so Prabhupada says how this takes place. In the Bhagavad Gita 10:11, the Lord says that in order to show special favor to his pure devotees, he personally eradicates the dense darkness of all misgivings. Here's Krishna coming in again, killing the Kaitava demon in the heart. And how he does it? He personally eradicates the dense darkness of all misgivings by switching on the light of pure knowledge within the heart of a devotee. So this is the experience we are talking about that comes through disciplic succession. And that the teachers in the disciplic succession have had. It's not just that they've heard some theory, but by practicing the jnana, by vijnana, then there's a transformation, and the source of knowledge turns out to be not way in the past, you know, 3,000 or 5,000 years ago when Krishna spoke to Arjuna on the battle of Kurukshetra, but now it's immediate. It's both in the past and immediate. In some ways, this disciplic succession, which is a story about history, if it's working properly, it abolishes history and brings everybody into the same immediacy of presence. And when that presence is realized, that is to say, the presence of Krishna, the presence of the soul before Krishna, it's taken care of. It's indubitable knowledge. And knowing God, being a spirit soul, and knowing another spiritual being is different from myself being a spirit soul and through the instrumentation of the body, knowing matter. There's the famous case, you know, of René Descartes, you know. How do I know you're there? How do I know you're not a figment of my imagination? This is sense perception. Oh, the sense perception's reliable, but yet, you know, there could be some evil demon who's projecting this on the screen, the famous Matrix example, so much beloved by the modern commentators in the month. How do I know that the whole thing isn't, you know, a virtual reality? But when you see Krishna, knowing Krishna is something like knowing ourselves. Descartes said, you know, I can't doubt that. I can't doubt that my own existence. Prabhupada actually appreciated this point. I because he's talking about his existence as a conscious being. That's indubitable. And then actually using an ontological argument, next thing he deduces infallibly is the existence of God. And then carries on from there. So the same way knowing God is something like knowing ourselves, has the same kind of indubitability. I don't know. So this is what happens. He personally eradicates the dense darkness of all misgivings by switching on the light of pure knowledge within the heart of a devotee. Therefore, because of the personality of Godhead's taking charge of illuminating the heart of his devotee, certainly a devotee engaged in this transcendental love cannot remain in darkness. He comes to know everything of the absolute and the relative truths. The devotee cannot remain in darkness, and because a devotee is enlightened by the personality of Godhead, his knowledge is certainly perfect. This is not the case for those who speculate on the absolute truth by dint of their own limited power of approach. Perfect knowledge is called parampara. But you see, this parampara doesn't just involve hearing from the outside, but by applying it also, it's met from the other side, from the inside. This perfect knowledge is called parampara, or deductive knowledge coming down from the authority to the submissive aural receiver who is bona fide by service and surrender. Therefore, that person is also qualified or capable. One cannot challenge the authority of the Supreme and know him also at the same time. I mean, there's a whole history in that sense, huh? Why God has disappeared from the modern world. Nobody knows, where is he? He reserves the right of not being exposed to such a challenging spirit of an insignificant spark of the whole, a spark subject to the control of the illusory energy. The devotees are submissive, and therefore the transcendental knowledge descends from the personality of God into Brahma, and from Brahma to his sons and disciples in succession. So this descent of knowledge, again, it happens over time, but also it happens immediately or directly. This process is helped by the Supersoul within such devotees. That is the perfect way of learning transcendental knowledge. This enlightenment perfectly enables the devotee to distinguish spirit from matter, because the knot of spirit and matter is untied by the Lord. This knot is called ahankara, and it falsely obliges a living being to become identified with matter. As soon as this knot is loosened, therefore, all the clouds of doubt are at once cleared off. One sees his master and fully engages himself in the transcendental loving service of the Lord, making a full termination of the chain of fruitive action. So that's what happens. So that's the. So Kapila Dev will teach us how to do that. Teach Devahuti and ourselves, who will be able to sit in on this conversation. Privileged access, members only. Any questions or comments? Yes?
Are there examples or analogies we can give in preaching to show that we're distinct from the intelligence and the false ego?
Analogies?
Or examples, like you give examples to show people how to perceive.
Are there any examples? The difference is that, the best way to explain it that I can come about is the difference between the seer and the seen. So you are the seen. So where are you? So the seer is the subject and the seen is the object. So usually this is a metaphor of vision, right? I mean, I see with my eyes. So I am the subject, and then what I see is my environment. The self and the not self. But then if we take seeing as just meaning perception, I have my body is really an array of organs of perception. Some of them, like the skin, is spread all over the place, and others are localized, but it's basically a support structure for an array of organs of perception. Yet my body is working, and I'm aware of my body is working. My eyes see, I know that my eyes see. My hands move, I know that my hands move. So still, if we make the distinction between the seer and the seen, then I can understand that because I'm aware of or seeing this gross body, that I'm not the body. So that way we drive the border between the self and the not-self back from the skin to wherever the border is between, say, the mind and the body. But then also, I can also watch my mind. It goes through all its trips and its different things like that. And I can also even study my own intelligence. And this is what people call self-awareness. And we're really, mentally self-aware people in the West. We got like two mirrors facing each other, and there's a P infinitely replicated in our self-analysis. So we're always aware of what we're doing. People report who have gone hysterical or mentally ill. They're freaking out. What they describe as part of themselves is sort of up far away. They've disassociated and are just watching the whole process as they chew the carpet and pour gasoline over themselves and look for a match and all this stuff. One part is just very detached watching. That watcher is the seer. So if we can watch our mental operations and emotional operations and intellectual operations and critically examine them, we do this in academics all the time. We think about thinking. In fact, we think about thinking about thinking. That's about as far as you can go. Finally, you have to push the boundary between the You're not the mind either, or the subtle body. You're just the perceiver. So we have to understand that our environment is really our own subtle body. The environment is not the world out there. This world is also the world out there. I mean, our body. Our mind means simply that part of the subtle body is that part of material nature to which we have the most immediate access. How we have that access is a little mysterious. You have no idea how it is when you decide you want to move your arm and it goes up, how you did that. You know, if I made the book go up by thinking like that, you'd think it was a miracle that my mind goes up, my arm goes up when I want to. How did that happen? I was equally mysterious as if the book went up. So that's the best way. Just systematically draw the border, at least for me, between the self and the not-self until you understand that the not-self includes the body and the mind. You in back? Yeah?
Sometimes Srila Prabhupada uses the word deductive in relation to
the Karma
Karat. Yeah. Can you explain exactly what it means? Because it doesn't seem like it's the same thing in
Karma. No, it's a different use of the word. But deductive... I think of it as an analogy. In a deductive argument, if the premises are true, then it's sure and certain that the conclusion are true. So in that way, it is infallible. You don't make any mistakes, and the argument itself guarantees that if the premises are true, then the conclusion is true. Because really, there's nothing in the conclusion that's not already in the premises. And so you're just bringing it out. So in that way, this has the same. So this is called, actually, the Sanskrit, you know, descending. Whereas the opposite, the inductive process, is obviously weak. You can have, in an inductive argument, all your premises can be true. But the conclusion can be false. So the argument form itself is not reliable. Yeah? Yeah?
Mm-hmm. You were discussing that the realization of the knowledge comes by the application. I just wonder, we are hearing, we are receiving the knowledge by hearing the living sound, but also Shravana is also service. So is it possible to realize by hearing, like Parikshin Maharaj, realize the teaching that she could...
Sure. Sure it is. But you have to hear in the right way. Simple hearing is not enough, Prabhupada said. One has to hear with rapt attention. One cannot be here with rapt attention unless one is pure in mind. One cannot be pure in mind unless one is pure in all one's actions. One cannot be pure in all his actions unless he's pure in eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. So... you learn how to hear, yeah. It can be done. That's true. Okay. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.